Let's talk about your book in the company of writers. I understand this began as an oral history.
Yes, it did.
Tell me about how it started.
Joel Gardner came to me under the auspices of the Columbia Oral History Project and suggested that he might do an oral history of my life, and particularly with emphasis on the publishing, the business aspect of the life. And we hit it off just fine, and and it went so well, and there was so much material that interested him as he was taking this testimony that he pretty much came up with the idea that there was enough there to make a book out of it. So we really went into the oral history side of it in greater depth than we would otherwise do, knowing that it might be the nest egg and the beginning of a book.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the origins of both yourself and Scribner's, which is one of the most famous names in publishing. Of course, Scribner's predated you by many, many years.
Well, it certainly did, I'm happy to say. It was my great-grandfather that that started the company in the early 1830s. I think it was 1830 something.
Oh, that long ago.
Yeah, I think so. Mm. I think so. And it was a family business. My grandfather and his brothers participated in that business. It had started as Scribner and Company, but then when later on it was called Charles Scribner's apostrophe S Sons, the name being Sons because the sons of the founder were all in the business. That's why there's that sort of apostrophe, Charles Scribner's Sons.
Now the founder was your great-grandfather.
Great-grandfather, yes.
So the company, up until its fairly recent sale to Macmillan, was
yes.
always a family-owned company.
Very much so.
So it was expected that you join the company, is that correct?
Yes, that was quite the, if I might say so, the strong expectation. In fact, I mean, I was really sort of saw this down the line in my boyhood that I would be expected to go into the family business, and not as the result of any attempt to train or anything else. It's just the notion that it's what I would probably be expected to do.
And yet, I believe you say in your book that if you'd had your druthers, you would rather have become an academic.
If at that time, I probably would have become an academic. The time that the decision was finally made was after the war, and then I had a choice to go into something else or to stay with the family business, and I elected to stay.
As you went to Princeton, what did you study at Princeton?
Well, I was a classics major. I studied Latin and Greek, and then a lot of Romance languages. So it was really a language education, pretty much.
You can almost say Scribner's is a Princeton firm, huh?
It certainly is. It's I don't know whether we're part of Princeton or Princeton is part of us, but we're very close.
But your father, I believe, established a library at Princeton.
I know. Yes, I think he did. That's quite right.
He did.
It was a gift to Princeton as part of the Firestone Library. He wasn't responsible for the whole Firestone Library, which is like the New York Public Library in a sense. But he did make significant contributions to the Princeton Library, the Firestone Library.
In fact, there is a photograph saying in your book, saying the Scribner Building, home of the Princeton University Press, designed
yes.
by Uncle Ernest Flagg.
That's right. Now, that Princeton University Press was a gift to Princeton from my grandfather, Charles Scribner. He thought that it was would be desirable for the university to have its own printing establishment, and he gave such an establishment lock, stock, and barrel to Princeton. It was called the Scribner the Princeton University Press.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that is also referred to as the Scribner Building.
Now, before you actually began with the firm, you were in the Navy.
Yes, I was.
Tell me about your job in the Navy.
Well, it was quite an interesting job. When the war started after Pearl Harbor, there was some effort on the part of the government to recruit people for cryptanalysis. That would be the code breaking. And one of my professors nominated me for that job as a cryptanalyst. And I went to Washington to work on help breaking the Japanese codes, and I did that all my time in the Navy until I was finally returned to civilian life.
You did it again during the Korean War.
Yes, I was called back again.
Yeah. So you got out of the Navy, and it was about 1945, 46?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I came back in the 50s, I think, and then after I was married, and my wife and I lived in Washington for a short spell then.
Well, here you are, a young man in 1946, just out of the Navy, fairly newly married, and you walk into Scribner's, your first day on the job. What was that like?
Well, I can't say that I had no contacts with Scribner's, and I was familiar with it, but suddenly I was given what the Navy people call the con. I was the responsible for the company as the chairman of the board and president.
But you didn't start as president, chairman.
No, I didn't. A few years before my father died.
Well, those are the years I wanted to focus on. Because when you walked in, what was it like? Was it saying, "Hey, look, here's Charlie, the owner's son, and what are we going to do with him?"
I'm afraid there might have been a little bit of that. Yes, I think that's possible. They gave me a lot of strange things to do. I read some proof. I did advertising for some of our books, even our children's books. So I had a course in that, and I just did a little of everything.
Did you have any particular mentor outside of your father during these days?
No, I really didn't have much of a mentor. The man that was head of the advertising was fired. About the time I came in, so he wasn't terribly enthusiastic about my training.
But you must have learned there were great editors there, such as Maxwell Perkins.
Yes, but I didn't have a great deal of contact with him either. Occasionally I would have some books assigned to me to do, or to write the jacket blurbs, and I did a lot of advertising copy, but to tell you the truth, I really didn't know a thing about it.
Well, what did they expect you to do? Learn the business by osmosis?
I'm afraid that they did. And I was just maybe foolish enough or arrogant enough to give it a try.
But you point out in your book, The Company of Writers, that despite the prominence of the firm Scribner's, it was really a rather shaky organization at that time.
Yes, I think it was sort of a little bit coasting on its past, to put it simply. I think it was a little bit coasting. Max Perkins was was still alive, but he died shortly afterwards, and and my father didn't live a long time after Max Perkins' death. So I, in a fairly short time, a matter of a few months, I was sort of left with the responsibility. I think the only active thing I did early on was when they asked me to write to Hemingway and to get in contact with him about a preface that he had written for Farewell to Arms. And I wrote to Ernest, and they were all afraid of him at that time in the company, because he had blotted his copybook on something that he didn't, that the company had blotted its copybook on something that upset Ernest, and so they enlisted me to deal with Hemingway, because they figured that I was could be cannon fodder, so to speak. As it turned out, Hemingway wrote back to me just the nicest letter that anyone could have written, and treated me as though we were lifelong pals, and I thought that was really terribly nice. Then later, when my father died and we were living in Washington, he wrote me a lovely letter saying that he appreciated the difficulties I would have since I had my father's estate and have the company, that, and he said, that's too much for any one person, and I just want you to know that you can... I think in so many words, not to worry about me or not to worry about him or his loyalty. And to somebody in that situation that I was in, I must say that gave me the warmest and most grateful feelings toward Hemingway. And it gave a side of Ernest that was there all the time. I mean, he's a very capable of great kindness and thoughtfulness.
But you were in an awkward position, because you did not have experience as an editor or even an acquiring editor. You really started in the business side, didn't you?
I did start quite a lot in the business side. I think that I was a bookish person, so I felt at home with books and in that side of it. But my greatest lack of experience was business experience. And you can't just pick somebody up and expect them to run a company, particularly when they don't have any really sense of running a company. I mean, the financial necessities of setting up proper business procedures and so on. I really knew very little about that. And I think now, looking back on it, I missed a lot of possibilities, and did very poorly in other fields because I just didn't know enough about business.
So it was kind of like on-the-job training.
Yeah, it was on-the-job training with rather important responsibilities.
But you did recognize some weaknesses. For example, I understand in reading your book that Scribner's had its own printing press.
That's right.
And that was a problem.
That was a problem because it was sort of a captive press and was not making money, and I had to... make the unwelcome decision of simply discarding that company, with a great loss of many jobs, and it was a rather traumatic situation. But we were able to dismantle the printing press with virtually no one being not being accounted for getting another job. So it was benign in that respect.
That was, I think, after Scribner's abandoned its press, I think Doubleday was the only one that had its own printing press.
That's right. That's quite right. That's quite right.
So it just wasn't profitable for a publishing firm to actually operate, print its own books.
No, and particularly unprofitable to try to print one's own books and bind them and everything else within a building in New York City, because it just wasn't equipped for that. A plant is most efficient when it's all on one level, and if it's on different levels, all the things have to be in the lovely phrase jackassed from one floor to another, and that was expensive in itself, and of course all the other difficulties of a company in the city of that kind. It really should be out in the country somewhere where most of the printing establishments were. That was another problem.
Now, you recognized another problem as well, and that was the type of books. Scribner's was a very heavy literary house, and I understand in reading in the Company of Writers that fiction is not necessarily the thing that keeps a company going.
No, it isn't. You've got to have a pretty balanced program of books. You can't just you can't just get by with fiction. Fortunately, we did have, when I came in and had the responsibility for the company, we did have a children's book department run by a lady called Alice Dalgleish, and she was able to do very well without any help from me. So there was a thing I didn't have to worry about, and in fact, she taught me a great deal about book publishing.
Athenaeum, where did that enter the picture?
Well, Pat Knopf had started this firm, Athenaeum, with Hiram Hayden and Mike Bessie and other individuals. And later, Knopf joined our company, and we had a combined company of including his people and our people.
Scribner's and Athenaeum.
Yes. Strictly speaking, in financial terms, we took over Athenaeum, but they were able to maintain their independence as publishers under the arrangement of the takeover.
But in effect, Athenaeum became the literary arm of Scribner's.
It became an important literary arm. They kept their name of Athenaeum, and Scribner's kept their list of a list of trade books, but they were all under one overall financial roof.
But the company kept going. It survived. You learned the business. But at some point, it was decided to do what many independently owned companies did and have done, and I'm afraid are still doing,
yes.
And that is to sell the company to a larger entity. And that was Macmillan.
Yes.
Tell me how was that decision reached? What happened exactly?
Well, I felt that it was I felt a difficulty in coordinating all the branches of a combined company, and I thought that it probably the time had come for us to put ourselves under a bigger roof, which was the Macmillan Company.
Well, wasn't that a rather traumatic decision to make? For example, your son, for example, is in the business.
Yes.
And, here the company had been a family-owned firm since the 1830s, and all of a sudden it's no longer there.
Yes, of course it was a difficult decision to make and a painful one, but there were a great many pains near at hand as the result of trying to make a go of it as we were. And I thought that it would be better for the company as a whole to have us under stronger management. And if I've ever made any successful decision, that was certainly Sydney won. That was a decision I've never looked back on with regret of any kind, and nothing more than satisfaction that we were able to do that. You know, the Roman philosopher said that fate leads the willing and drags the unwilling, and I was more prepared to be led than dragged.
Of course, that meant the demise of your own job as well.
No, it didn't. It was my own position.
Yes, that's your own position.
Right. But my son carried on in the company and is happily an employee there right now.
Well, let's look back a little bit at some of the individual titles and authors. Were there any books that came your way that you didn't publish that you wish you had?
I'm sure that there were a number, but I just can't think of a good example now. Oh, there were many books that I wished that I had, but that's different from books that I didn't accept. In other words, some books that I didn't have, because I really had no opportunity to make an offer for them. But there were other cases where I could have had a book if I'd had the brains or the initiative to get it, I'm sure.
Well, how does a publisher decide what books to publish?
Well, one basis for such a decision is where their strengths lie. Scribner's had always had quite a strong fiction list, and there was a tradition there of Scribner books. It was a good one, and that was an area in which agents would often turn to us because they knew that we were experienced publishers of trade books. But gradually, if I can jump ahead a little bit here, gradually I began to feel that the publication of trade books was a pretty chancy business and didn't really have the strength to put all your eggs in that basket. And I think that then I was looking around for other kinds of books. We had children's books, and suddenly I hit upon the notion of publishing one or two major reference books. That started with the Dictionary of American Biography, but I switched it. I kept the same reference book approach in other fields of history of science, of history of literature, and so on. So I think the biggest thing I did from a publishing point of view was to develop a very, very strong list of multi-volume reference works in almost every department of knowledge.
And these were successful?
Very successful, and virtually every single one of those books that were started are still in print now.
Are they updated too?
Yes, they're very often updated when that is appropriate, and with all kinds of updating apparatus.
One thing we didn't mention was the Scribner's bookstore on Fifth Avenue.
Oh, yes. That was such a lovely building, and I really loved it dearly. On a nice spring or summer day, I'd look, might be in the back of the store and looked out over Fifth Avenue and saw these blue and white awnings and knew that it was my building and company, and it was just like having the most beautiful yacht in the world. I just really loved looking at it and seeing it and being a part of it. And that was very sad to lose that. But on the other hand, it was taken by very people that cared a lot about it, too. And it's there.
Brentano's.
Yeah, Brentano's.
Scribner sold that whole building, didn't he?
Sold the whole building. We sold the whole building. See, we didn't really go part way in that decision, but it was a very, very wise one, because if we had been stuck with that building.
Well, what remains of Scribner's now other than its backlist? Nothing. I mean, the building is gone, the bookstore is gone, the printing plant is gone.
Well,
just
all
the
those,
name is
all of those things are gone, except the continuation of the books, which have, almost all of which are thriving. Certainly, the reference book program. So, I can't say that in that the imprint is no longer alive or recognized, because indeed it is. And Macmillan has taken a number of their books and put it under the and using the Scribner imprint, and that gives me a great joy, you know, that that the name is very much alive in that field too, and of the trade books, and I really see no cause for grief.
Now, publishing, it seems to be a very small industry that wields an enormous influence over and above its size.
Well, I think it does have quite an influence, and people seem to know more about it than they know than other products. Solzhenitsyn said once that a writer is another government. A writer is a second government. When you think of Dickens and the impact that Dickens had in Victorian England and other similar cases. And so I think writers and writing have always had an impact on society of great weight, and that weight and that effect of writers on society has kept people minded of writing and publishing.
Well, I was astounded to learn that some of the original first editions of famous books by Faulkner and even Hemingway were published in editions of 2,000 and less. Mm. I mean, that's
yes.
Nothing.
Yes, that's
nothing.
Quite true.
And yet those books are giants of literature.
That's quite true. It seems almost as though the whole financial thing was on a smaller scale, doesn't it?
Well, when you think about a radio station or
yes.
a television station
yes.
and people by the yes. thousands, millions
yes.
tune it in every day,
yes.
and then a book is published
yes.
in an edition of
yes.
5,000.
Yes.
Well, I mean, they're outside of the blockbusters,
yes.
you know, the big
yes, I know
Stephen
what you,
King's.
I see what you mean.
But
yes.
it's so small when you think
That's
about it.
That's true, but it's small like Little David was mm. small, but oh my. And I think that is true. A friend of mine, a teacher of Italian in Colombia, said that when he was a boy in Italy, Hemingway's books had been superbly translated into Italian by Italian translators, but very well done from the English. And they were best sellers in Italy during the war, with the young people as well. And he told me that, in his opinion, the novels of Ernest Hemingway had some influence in keeping Italy on the side of the Allies rather than going in the direction of the Russian.
Mm.
And I think that that's just one little instance, but this is a very sophisticated man, and that's what he believed.
Well, I don't know if Einstein's theory of relativity was ever published, but if it had been, it would probably be in a minute edition.
Oh, yes, indeed.
And look at the influence that's
yes,
had on
indeed.
Physics
yes.
and science.
Exactly, exactly. You really can't measure a way or those achievements. They come into another sphere of activity.
Well, they're intellectual achievements, but not financial ones. I understand that Faulkner, for example, until he won the Nobel Prize for Literature, never made a dime on his book.
I think that's true, and I think that that's true of many of the great writers in their early years. Even the successful ones weren't making all that much money.
Well, now that's a big complaint of many writers, I understand. The publishers are skinflints. They won't pay anything for the books.
Well, I can't say I haven't heard that argument.
I bet you have. Well, tell me, you've been in publishing for many years. Do you have any? What do you expect publishing to be like in the future? Any predictions?
Well, one prediction is I expect that it will continue, maybe with changes, but I think there will always be a place in the sun for writers, and I think that the book is a very practical way of packaging intellectual property, and I'm not excited by all the so-called substitute for books, because I think books have proved that they're a very efficient and attractive and sensible way of packaging manuscripts and writings.
I agree with you, but I also understand that that a lot of publishing is antiquated in how it approaches the publication of books. For example, the refusal of many publishers to accept manuscripts on computer disk, so everything has to be retyped,
yes,
and edited in galleys and this sort of thing. Isn't that kind of old-fashioned?
Yeah, I think that is old-fashioned. I see a number of situations in scholarly publishing and so on where it's expected that a lot of material will come in on disk. Is it diskettes?
Mm-hmm.
So that there are those innovations.
And other things, too, the distribution of books. You know, it is kind of archaic when you think about it, because here you have to have a book that has to be published on paper and bound, and a dust jacket has to be printed, and it's got to be packed in boxes and sent to warehouses. And you know, it is kind of an old-fashioned way of disseminating information.
I think it is old-fashioned in that respect, and in another respect, it's very hard, I think, for a young writer to find, oftentimes to find a publisher to look at what they've written. I years ago, when I was had some closeness to that, I just simply couldn't discard a book without looking at it a little bit, without taking a look at it. And I think it's possible that some of my colleagues and other firms just send it back. I think that that's rather like Hollywood, too, because in Hollywood, somebody submitting a screenplay probably won't have it read, because the person that owns the company would be afraid that their idea might have been stolen or something like that.
There are only about 15, 20 publishers now who do trade editions.
That's right.
If you look at their catalogs every year, 100 books, 200 books.
It's a small field.
Yeah, I understand that the major publishing houses, for every 10,000 manuscripts they get, they might select one.
Yes.
So it makes it very difficult for people who write to get published.
Yes, I worry a lot about that. And it grieves me. Sometimes my friends say, "What do you do to get published?" And I say, "It's very difficult in most instances. But why do you have to be published when there is some value in writing for its own sake? You can do watercolors without being displayed. You can do other things. You can become practice in music without playing in Carnegie Hall. Why isn't there some intrinsic satisfaction and pleasure out of writing?
Don't you remember what Dr. Johnson said? Only a blockhead
would
write without...
Who am I to argue with Dr. Johnson?
But
I think he's right.
I understand what you're saying, but the fact of the matter is, creative people find it necessary to share their ideas and their thoughts. their art, and to write or to paint for its own self and then put it into a drawer or to a closet doesn't fulfill that need.
Oh, that's terribly disappointing, because that has not fulfilled really any need. But I have to say that Malcolm Forbes, about a few years ago, asked me out of the blue if I would write a column for his newspapers in New Jersey. I'd never written a column in my life, and I said, sure, I'll do it. And I wrote a weekly column for months, and I had a tremendous amount of fun out of it. I did it as a favor for Malcolm, but I got a lot of letters back, and I wasn't making my living out of it, but it was a great satisfaction.
Well, I bet it's a great satisfaction after all of the books that you have published to actually have written one.
Yes, so that was the greatest satisfaction of all.
Charles Gilbert, Jr.
That was great.
Very nice talking to you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.